Good afternoon. We'd like to welcome you to our afternoon session of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. By way of brief announcement, we still have tickets available for the dinner tonight and would encourage you to consider that as a possibility. The dinner will feature four local clergymen, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, and Catholic, who will discuss from their viewpoints the effects of the Mormon theology. We're very fortunate this afternoon in this session to receive papers, a paper from Edwin Gosted, professor of history at University of California at Riverside, very distinguished author. Professor Gosted has written Atlas of American Religion, Dissent in American Religion, and several other books, and is eminently qualified to present his paper entitled History and Theology, The Mormon Connection. He will be responded to by Dr. James Clayton, Dean of the Graduate School here at the University of Utah, and also Professor of Religion. So we'll proceed in that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the respondent, Professor of History at the University of Utah, I will say that he got the paper only yesterday and therefore has only limited liability. On behalf of myself, I will say the reason that he got the paper only yesterday is that I learned only earlier this week that there was to be a respondent. So, having established that both of us are totally irresponsible and not to be held accountable for anything that may follow, I will proceed. The British historian F.M. Powick has observed that the Christian religion is a daily invitation to the study of history. I believe that the same can be said, underlined, and italicized for the Mormon religion. Thus, what I would like us to do together is to reflect briefly on some of the relationships between religious and historical understandings. First, with respect to Christianity generally, then with respect to Mormonism more particularly. Considering history and theology initially in the context of the Christian religion does have, I think, some legitimacy. First, Christianity is, in the Western world, a reasonably familiar item. Second, that religion has a long and reasonably well-documented history. And third, it is relevant to our most specific subject, which is, after all, the Church of Jesus Christ of LDS, not the Church of Joseph Smith of LDS. To return to Powick's comment, the Christian religion is indeed enmeshed in history. Christianity may often have been described, and I'm sure still will be, as primarily a religion, quote, of the book, unquote. But it is also unmistakably a religion of history. To quote a familiar New Testament verse, God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. While this is preeminently a statement of theology, it surely purports to be a statement of history as well. And so one has not only Christian philosophies of history, but Christian practitioners of history. If there is a tendency to be embarrassed about the modifying adjective, there's really no need to be, because these days most historians carry around some sort of modifier with them: intellectual, social, radical, statistical, political, economic, military, or what have you. But does not being a Christian historian create special difficulties different in kind from those imposed by the labels which I have just named? I think the answer to that question has to be yes. Some special difficulties, but perhaps also some special opportunities or contributions. One of the difficulties is concealed in my glib use of the word Christian, as though that had some universal acceptability. Of course, you know that is not the case. Though the Protestant Reformation, or revolt, and we can't even agree on that, is nearly half a millennium behind us, we have only recently ceased to ask of a biography of Luther or of an account of the Inquisition, is the author Protestant or is he Catholic? To respond simply that the author is Christian would be to indulge in the most intolerable evasion. And in surveying the whole history of the Christian Church, surely it has made much difference whether the writing of that whole history was done by an Eastern Orthodox, a Roman Catholic, a German Lutheran, a Scottish Presbyterian, or a British Unitarian. As one Christian historian, E. Harris Harbison, remarked, sectarian prejudice has long been a notorious obstacle in the path of historical understanding. It is true that strident polemicism and narrow parochialism are familiar faults in Christian history. Even more serious criticism was leveled against that kind of history by the fierce philosophers of the Enlightenment era. Christian historians, they said with ill-concealed disgust, ignore all those civilizations not dominated by the church. They quarrel over petty party differences. They find a miracle for every difficulty in causation, and they rely on revelation for every declaration of purpose. The well-known Roman Catholic historian John Tracy Ellis reminds us of the historical method employed by the 9th century Bishop of Ravenna as he was doing a series of biographies of various earlier bishops. Quoting this 9th century bishop, "Where I have not found any history of these bishops and have not been able by conversation with aged men or inspection of the monuments or from any other authentic source to obtain information concerning them, in such a case, in order that there might not be a break in the series, I have composed the life myself with the help of God and the prayers of the brethren." Such a technique does indeed prevent Christian history from full participation in the general historical enterprise. But I should add that such a technique is more typical of an earlier day than of our own. So Christian history is vulnerable to criticism and even to attack. It also has, however, some powerful potential. First, as Augustine noted, the history of the city of God is one of meaning and direction. Rejecting the notion of history as repetitive cycle on the one hand, or whirling chaos on the other, the Bishop of Hippo found in history a dynamism and a purpose, indeed ultimately a consummation. Christian theology emerges from history, from the history of God's dealings with humankind. And religious thought for the Christian cannot be placed in a category wholly separate from historical thought. In his popular little book entitled Christianity and History, Herbert Butterfield has written as follows: "The Christian must find that religious thought is inextricably involved in historical thought. The historical Jesus, on the one hand, brings to a climax the developments of ancient history, gathering up the whole story and fulfilling the things to which the Old Testament had so often pointed. In this respect, his life, his teaching, his personality are the subject of an historical narrative which knits itself into the story of the Roman Empire. Over and above all this, continuing with Butterfield, over and above all this, however, Christianity is an historical religion in a particularly technical sense that the term possesses. It presents us with religious doctrines which are at the same time historical events or historical interpretations. In particular, it confronts us with the questions of the incarnation, the crucifixion, the resurrection, questions which may transcend all the apparatus of the scientific historian, as indeed many other things do, but which imply that Christianity has rooted its most characteristic and daring assertions in the ordinary realm of history. Butterfield continues, the fact that Christianity comes down to us as an historical religion in this sense is bound to provide certain bearings for the interpretation of the whole drama of human life on this earth, bound to affect, for example, any views or dim feelings that we may have concerning the whole scheme of things in time. We might say, in other words, that for the Christian historian, God is not dead, and therefore Whirl is not king. Second, the Christian historian approaches the vast canvas of the human past with a point of view, a perspective, even perhaps a passion. Now, in an earlier day, this might have been seen more as liability than asset. In our own time, however, a total and impersonal objectivity is seen more as delusion and snare. The historian does not and cannot stand apart from the stream which he attempts to describe. He is not sitting in the balcony watching life being played upon the stage, for he too is on that stage. He too is one of the players. Those philosophers I mentioned a moment ago of the Enlightenment fancied themselves operating in the context of full and total objectivity, shorn of all prejudice and presupposition. But as Karl Becker demonstrated long ago, they too were captives of a prevailing climate of opinion. They too burned down one heavenly city, only to erect another in its place. The Roman Catholic historian Eric Cochran believes that the committed Christian historian has at least two advantages over his secular counterpart. First, he's likely to take religious issues and religious ideas and religious motives seriously. He may even go to the extreme of knowing a little theology. And second, such a historian, says Cochran, follows his scholarly pursuit as a holy vocation. Catholic historians, he writes, must regard the work of historical inquiry not as a way of gaining social prestige, of building academic empires, or of making payments on suburban swimming pools. Rather, he sees the enterprise, the calling, as a process of sanctification, both for the historian herself or himself, and for those she or he reaches through the work. Cochran acknowledges that talent reigns on the just and unjust alike, the corollary being, of course, that the lack of talent also reigns on the just and unjust alike. But he sees the calling as an added incentive to hard work, diligence, and thoroughgoing honesty. He quotes with approval Giuseppe Alberigo, "All historical research conducted with scientific rigor is a spiritual adventure, and research into the history of the church is also a religious experience. A third potential for Christian history, not always realized, is the capacity for universality, for empathy as broad as the human race. As I've already acknowledged, Christian history has often degenerated into partisan polemical history, where the circle of sympathy has been so narrowed as to exclude 9/10 of the human race. God's love, ocean-wide, is meted out thimbleful by thimbleful. The contemporary Peruvian theologian, Gustavo Gutierrez, would have us understand salvation, and by implication, therefore, even salvation history, to be the communion of all human beings with God and among themselves. He does not find it useful to speak any longer of a profane world, for grace, whether accepted or rejected, is present among all peoples, and all human activity thereby comes within the scope of Christian concern. There is only one human destiny, he writes, and the history of salvation is the very heart of human history. This gives history its unity and salvation its universality. Those who try to rescue salvation out of all history, to save it exclusively for their own group or class or nation, will end up losing it. The salvation of Christ, Gutierrez concludes, is a radical liberation from all misery, all despoliation, all alienation. Far too often, however, one does not see this universality, but a fateful linking of the message of salvation to a particular cultural mode, to a single epoch. If Ptolemaic astronomy falls, then Christianity must fall. If Darwin be right, then Christ is of no avail. If capitalism collapses, then the church is doomed. In its first 300 years, Christianity was rarely tempted to wed itself to the political or economic or even scientific system of the day. In its critically formative period, it profited from its cultural alienation. Since that time, however, it has often succumbed to the dangerous temptation to identify God's will with its own, to make itself and its institutions the very center of the universe. This brief prolegomenon has been an effort to suggest that the problems of Mormon history and theology are not unrelated to the larger questions of Christian history and theology. Larger only in a time and geographical sense. I do not suggest identity, nor do I question the uniqueness of each historical situation. Some psychic distance, some historical perspective, however, may be gained by seeing a single religious tradition in the context of a larger one. But certainly one must not be oblivious to the differences. Mormon theology, and here when I say Mormon, I mean the Utah Church. Mormon theology, like Christian theology generally, sees direction and progress in history. But for the former, the development is without end, and nothing lies beyond time. Eternity, as Thomas O'Day pointed out, is simply indefinitely prolonged time, during which man, in cooperation with God, gains mastery over the other elements in nature. So not just history is dynamic, but everything, all reality is on the move, purposefully, progressively, endlessly. Mormonism has a process philosophy quite apart from the underpinnings of Whiteheadian thought. and a sense of time from which nothing in the universe is exempt. Such a view intensifies the connection between history and theology to a point even greater than that found in traditional Christian thought. Also relevant to the understanding of history in the Mormon view is the Mormon view of the nature of God and the nature of man. In brief, one could say God has more limits and man fewer limits than in much traditional Christian thought. God is finite, subject as all else to the vagaries of time, limited by the materials available to him for the creation of the world. To employ the language of Sterling McMurrin here, as a constructor or artisan God, not entirely unlike Plato's demiurge of the Timaeus, the Mormon deity informs the continuing processes of reality and determines the world's configurations. But he is not the creator of the most ultimate constituents of that world, either the fundamental material entities or the space and time that locate them. Continuing to quote, "It is a basic article of Mormon theology that God is related to a world environment for the being of which he is not the ultimate ground, and by which he therefore is in some sense conditioned. This means that God is a being among beings rather than being as such or the ground of being, and that he is therefore finite rather than absolute." McMurrin acknowledges that the language of absolutism and omnipotence is often more emotionally satisfying and is therefore to be found in many a Mormon sermon. But, quote, "like it or not, the Mormon theologian must sooner or later return to the finitistic conception of God upon which both his technical theology and his theological myths are founded," unquote. If the great gulf between God and man, as in, say, Augustinian theology or Calvinist thought, if that great gulf is narrowed by the limits placed upon God, it is further bridged by the high view taken of man. God is as man once was, and man may become as God now is. Man is not the fallen, depraved, impotent creature of much Christian thought, not the earthen pot complaining to the potter, "Why hast thou made me thus?" Original sin, with all its potential for debilitation or irresponsibility, is explicitly cast aside. Again, in the words of Professor McMurrin, to fail to recognize that at its foundation, Mormon theology is essentially a rebellion against especially the Orthodox Protestant dogma of original sin and the negativism implied by it for the interpretation of the whole nature and life of man. To fail to recognize this would be a failure to discern not only the distinctive character of Mormon doctrine, but also of the Mormon religion itself. The history of Mormon theology has been at many points a recasting of Pelagianism, Socinianism, or Arminianism in a 19th and 20th century role, but where reason and theological subtleties have counted for less than common sense insights, practical necessities, and dogmatic certainties. Now, such a high view of man's power and potential, particularly in 19th century America, could lead to a romanticizing of many hard facts in history and to a wishing away of the reality of evil. And 19th century America offers many examples of just such romanticism and such monism. Remarkably, Mormon theology, while exalting man, did not and does not obscure or minimize the force and fact of evil. Evil exists, but the freedom of man to do something about it also exists. Evil is not always the familiar blessing in disguise, not invariably an integral part of some overarching but hidden plan, not merely and evasively the absence of good without an independent existence of its own. But evil is, for God and man alike, a challenge, an occasion of struggle, endurance, and victory. And once again, it seems to me that in this theological context, history is magnified once more, not minimized. It is taken seriously in its own terms and not seen as some sort of pageant play or placement test for the world beyond. So the Mormon connection is a tight one between history and theology. And history is taken seriously within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Let me suggest four areas in which this appears to me to be the case. First, with respect to ancient history, as Richard Bushman has pointed out, one cannot take Mormon seriously as a religion without taking seriously its attention to ancient history in the Book of Mormon. This certainly need not imply that only one window should be opened to the ancient world. Single window history, like single issue politics, is a risky business. But it does imply that the timeline need not begin in 1830, and that the heritage of all human history is a legitimate and relevant part of the Mormon heritage. The 19th century Anglican cleric who by degrees moved into Roman Catholicism and became a cardinal, John Henry Newman, once remarked that to be deep into history is to cease to be a Protestant. Now, I naturally don't accept that since I am a Protestant and like to think I'm deep into history. But I acknowledge some force in that remark for those who see Protestantism wholly as the product of the 16th century, or for those who see history as having leaped miraculously from the apostolic age to the age of the Reformation, with nothing of relevance or significance having occurred in the intervening 1,500 years. So to steal from John Henry Newman, if you can steal from a cardinal, I might be tempted to say that to be deep into history is to cease to be a Mormon. But I hope that I've made clear in what sense I believe that both to be true and profoundly untrue. The Mormon past, properly apprehended, is an ancient and inclusive past. A second area of serious historical concern for Mormons is that of America and the New World. Here Mormons can helpfully remind all of us that the history of this hemisphere does not begin in 1492 or 1565 or 1607. But it is more than simple duration of time. America and the New World were being prepared for a new revelation, a timely restoration. And in the fullness of time, it came through the person and prophecy of Joseph Smith. A gospel out of America, about America, and to some degree of America. After the period of persecution, the Mormon dream seemed to tie itself more closely to the American dream, and for a time both fared remarkably well. Now the American dream falters a bit. I think we are living less in the fullness of time and more in the emptiness of time, but that may come from having watched two political conventions this summer. But now that the dream is faltering a bit, it is even more necessary for Mormonism to guard itself against a cultural captivity. But in any event, America's history has been taken seriously as being a result of divine guidance, as a preparation for and fulfillment of the promises of Zion. Third, Mormons have taken, and do take, their own particular history with deep earnestness. A century and a half of Mormon history in this country alone is filled with inexhaustible drama. The sources and resources brought to bear on this lively past are enormous. So familiar and unarguably is this the case, that I do not think the point needs to be labored. I would simply like to pay a personal tribute to one man, Leonard J. Arrington, for the quality and quantity of his labors in this entire realm. He has coaxed, cajoled, encouraged, guided, inspired countless young Mormon scholars in doing their history in a manner that is responsible, open, probing, devout. For non-Mormon scholars, he has opened doors and reduced suspicions on a scale that can only bode well for the future of the church. And most of all, he has personally set a standard for integrity for all the rest of us to follow, or at our peril, to ignore. Of Mormon history, as of Christian history generally, the time may come when we ask of any particular article, book, not was the author a Mormon or a non-Mormon, but was he an historian or a hack? Fourth, it is no secret anywhere in the scholarly world that Mormons take seriously their individual and family history. This Herculean enterprise is a matter of pride, and justifiably so, to the church at large as well as to each eager searcher. The raw data accumulated, and with the aid of modern technology disseminated and preserved, constitute a source of incalculable utility. It is true that historians, a proud and arrogant lot, do take pleasure in pointing out that genealogy is not history. In his recent book on the roots of modern Mormonism, Mark Leone indicates his reservations about what he calls amateur history, basically chronicle and vignette, not interpretation. Its skeleton is kinship, not politics or economics, and it is unreservedly uncritical. While Leone concedes that the church makes every effort to ensure the accuracy of the genealogical searches, he believes that those searches themselves give a strong egocentric perspective to all historical undertaking, with one of the results being that the broadest human grouping acknowledged is that of the family. The past is not seen in terms of larger entities or broad social forces or subterranean causes or profound cultural conflicts. When the approach to the past is essentially, if not exclusively, autobiographical, history, to use his word, is atomized. This kind of historical investigation also tends to be adulatory, to be an endorsement rather than a judgment of the present. And to quote Leone one more time, Mormons lock themselves into the present more effectively than the rest of society. They never see profound change and are even prevented from seeing the causes of it, because all history is an individual's reflection. And just as a mirror never tells the viewer what it saw yesterday, history never tells Mormons what they or their society looked like before. It cannot do so because the living Mormon is the image in the mirror. In all four areas of concern with the past, ancient history, New World history, denominational history, and family history, the attention is keen. Thus, to appropriate Powick's remark with which I began and change the word, the Mormon religion is a daily invitation to the study of history. That much, it seems to me, is fixed and sure. In the course of that study, and in scrutinizing the relationships between history and theology in the Mormon context, some problems or questions do remain, and in a most tentative and exploratory way. Let me suggest three areas in which both historians and theologians might wish to focus their reflections as far as the Mormon connection is concerned. First, they might ask, as I now do, whether an effort should not be made consciously and deliberately to lengthen the timeline of historical consciousness. To cite a facetious example, and since I said nice things about Leonard, he'll forgive me, I do trust for this. But a very nice book appeared in 1976 entitled Building the City of God, Community and Cooperation Among the Mormons, Deseret Book Company. Chapter 1, page 1 begins. When Sir Humphrey Gilbert's ship was swept by a sudden storm from her companion vessels in 1853 and lost with all on board, etc. Sir Humphrey Gilbert, 1853. I have not the slightest doubt that the authors wrote 1553, but I can just see that proofreader at the Deseret Book Company. This is a book about Mormons. Why, that can't be right, 1553. It must be a mistake. And so it gets changed. I have no idea, of course, what happened, and the example is deliberately facetious. But all American religion, as Sidney Mead long ago pointed out, suffers from a historylessness. For so many groups, and conspicuously the utopian and restorationist ones, the world began anew with their own founding. Now, for many reasons, as I have suggested, Mormonism has largely resisted this dismissal of the past and the consequent impoverishment of one's mental furnishings and surrounding culture. Largely resisted, but not totally. There is still a strong tendency to go back no farther than a single century or to find authentication chiefly or solely in one's own experience. All American pietism did and does the same thing, with the result that American religion is filled with institutions collapsed, beached, broken apart, abandoned, and with the result that culture within those pietistic groups was undernourished. Mormonism has too strong a sense of institution and authority for that kind of schismatic activity to go on, but cultural and personal enrichment can still be denied. Mormonism, which takes time so seriously, should gulp down larger and larger chunks of it from all humanity's past. Other religious bodies originating in 19th century America share this need, and they have responded to it variously. Christian Science, for example, turns far less to history than it does to philosophy. But in terms of its own denominational past, it has manifest great and often jealous concern. The recent writings of Robert Peel, however, help make possible a freer commerce between in-house historians and those who approach Christian Science from the outside. The movement led by Alexander Campbell, a contemporary of Joseph Smith's, has suffered internal discord and dissension, which has distracted the group from a steady concern with earlier Christian history. Yet several conferences and journal articles have endeavored to place that restoration movement into the larger context of the primitive and free church precedents. Seventh-day Adventists have recently been dismayed by the efforts of Ronald Numbers to place their foundress, Ellen G. White, more solidly in the company of her fellow health reformers of the 19th century. To be sure, some of these historical ways of thinking are quite new and therefore shocking. They can also be refreshing. A recent Seventh-day Adventist book looks at the question of Saturday and Sunday worship. Surely nothing new there, you say. But the look is not at 19th century America. Rather, it is at 2nd century Rome, and then to the whole patristic period and the transition, the gradual transition from the Jewish Sabbath to the Christian Sunday. This Adventist author is, moreover, the first non-Catholic graduate of the Pontifical Gregorian Institute in Rome. Scholarly barriers should be crossed with the same courage and zeal that missionaries have crossed ethnic and national barriers. Which leads to a second area for reflection. If history's timeline needs to be lengthened, its embrace can also be widened. Widened to include non-Mormons, both as the subjects of history and as the authors thereof. This conference is, of course, itself an example of what I mean, and I would like to think that it could have as readily occurred under the sponsorship of the Church. Why might it not have? Because there is a continuing defensiveness, an uneasiness, a garrison mentality, to use the phrase of Davis Bitton. And Mark Leone has commented that Mormons seem at the moment to be the sole owners of their own past. Much of this is very understandable. When others were owners of the Mormon past in earlier generations, they manhandled it rather badly, which is to say horribly. And ordinary horse sense might suggest, therefore, that one not surrender a proprietary hold. Beyond that fact of the period of persecution and misrepresentation is the additional fact of this religion's visible and vulnerable youth. The formative years of a religion, consider Christianity once again, are turbulent and contradictory years, filled with false starts and misdirections. Senior citizens can afford to look back on the vagaries of pimply puberty with a certain philosophical calm, but not the adolescent himself, challenged without at every turn and tortured within by doubt and insecurity. Still another reason for being suspicious of the outsider is the theological novelty of the Utah Church, and novelty is only another word for heresy. In an earlier period, Mormons were condemned by the Gentile world for being polygamous and un-American. Now they are emphatically monogamous and vigorously American, and so all is forgiven and forgotten, unless somebody starts paying attention to theology. There, the traditional Christian, confronted by a finite God, an unfamiliar Trinity, an unlimited freedom, a forbidding temple ritual, may respond with new waves of wild accusation and scurrilous diatribe. Such a church might do well in this situation to keep its guard up against the outsider. But the church keeps its guard up against the insider, too. Against those intellectuals who move beyond amateur history and amateur theology. In a world clearly going awry, and I think that's unarguable, intellectuals can serve as convenient scapegoats, as threats to a restored faith and improved morals. It is in such a context, Davis Bitton has written, that we can best understand various efforts to seal off students from worldly ideas. The unwillingness in church periodicals to include different points of view or even critical letters to the editor. The hypersensitivity to criticism, the thirst for praise, the interminable self-congratulation at having the truth, and the suspicion greeting the historian who wishes to study Mormon history. Is it for us or against us? The assumption is, says Bitten, that the world is divided already between the sheep and the goats. So it is quite possible to understand the defensiveness. What is also required is an understanding of its cost. For history, shortened in time and narrowed in scope, loses its capacity to enlighten, to liberate, to offer that emancipation which comes with genuine self-understanding. If Calvinist theology has as its dangerous tendency the sinking into gloomy despair, becoming only a robot, Mormon theology may have a tendency toward a Pelagian or Promethean pride. And since that is the most threatening of all sins for all humanity, perhaps Mormon history, if broadened and lengthened, can be a needed corrective to this aspect of Mormon theology. However, to be successful in that regard, the approach to history, instead of reinforcing egocentricity, must transcend it. If our paths are to be guided by the light of experience, that light must shine as broadly and brightly as possible. The final area for reflection has not so much to do with the length or the breadth of history as with the attitude taken toward it. To put it succinctly, history must be seen as an ally and not as an enemy. Mormon theology knows no Vincentian formula. This is the formula of Vincent of Lorenz of the 4th century in the Roman Catholic tradition, that only that is to be believed which has been believed by all men always everywhere. That makes history pretty doggone hard to do. Mormon theology is not horrified by the notion that dogma has a history, that doctrine does develop, that revelation is not closed. Think of the real advantage, the Mormon edge, if you will, which this stance provides. No necessity for a Talmudic commentary to keep things going, or for a textual transmission apparatus, or for a council of imams, or for a collection of canon lawyers. Continuing revelation, far from being an embarrassment in the 20th century world, offers the opportunity for adaptation and growth, for flexibility and development, if it is taken seriously. The opportunity is enhanced by the absence of a class of professional theologians or official interpreters. Of course, the amateur status can become a liability as well. Certainly so, if obscurantism and mindless literalism take control. So another plea for the embrace of history with its instruction in ambiguity, variety, possibility, failure, and sin. The liberating power of history, I think, was well demonstrated in the publication in 1970 of Stephen Taggart's little book, Mormonism's Negro Policy, Social and Historical Origins, and Lester Bush's subsequent article. Change, wrote Taggart, must eventually come. And it did. I do not argue a post hoc ergo propter hoc, but I do argue that a recognition of the relativities of history made easier the modification of doctrine or practice. I argue also that Mormonism has the mechanism for change and development already in place. Another way in which to manifest the embrace of history rather than its disdain has to do with archives and the access thereto. In his recent book on the opening of the Vatican archives, Owen Chadwick details the elaborate intrigue, political and ecclesiastical, that kept these archives so long from the scholarly world, including even the kidnapping of a great portion of them by Napoleon in 1810. Not until the final decades of the 19th century were these archives opened. In the height of a renewed conflict then between science and religion, the Roman Catholic Church even released all of the Galileo manuscripts, concluding and rightly, I believe, that it had more to fear from imposing a rigid and authoritarian secrecy than it did from openness and honest scholarship. Leo XIII, in 1883, said, "Let nothing untrue be said, and nothing true be unsaid." And I have trouble regarding Leo XIII as a radical secularist. Of course there are risks, as freedom always involves risks. But a church which emphasizes so eloquently the absolute freedom of man cannot gracefully thwart that freedom's honorable exercise. So history must be embraced. But in 1980, this is far from a challenge to be set before Mormonism alone. I slip a little commercial in here, so be careful. All American society is turning its back on history, is ignoring or dismissing its past. Such recent books as Philip Reif's Fellow Teachers and Christopher Lash's The Culture of Narcissism bemoan the loss of historical memory, the reversion in America to a kind of barbarism. As Lash noted, a denial of the past at first appears progressive and optimistic, but on closer analysis, we see, said he, that it embodies the despair of a society that cannot face the future. So the problem is far greater than that represented by a single church or a particular tradition. The genial pontiff John XXIII turned out ultimately to rate about a 7.5 on the Richter scale. But among his many deeds and pronouncements are these words: "The best apology for the church is the impartial history of its life." Wise and welcome words for his or for any church. But, you say, they were a long time in coming, weren't they? Yes, and patience is an admirable virtue. Thank you.
Like you, I thought Professor Gostad's paper was an excellent one. I think he has informed us, challenged us, entertained us a bit, and presented all of this in a very gracious, Christian, tolerant manner. I appreciate very much your willingness to come and share these ideas with us. What I have to say will be in two parts. One, a few general comments about the nature of this subject, and then a few slight suggestions as to some of the content and the points that Professor Gostad made. First, this is a conference, or this section of this conference is on theology and history and its connection. By theology, I mean the systematic study of the nature of God and his relations with man. And by history, I understand that to be the study of man's past based on empirical evidence or records. And the first question that I had in reading Professor Gostad's paper is, to what extent is there a connection, and ought there to be a connection, between theology and history? There are indeed similarities. Both, in the final analysis, are acts of faith, as Becker and Beard and others have pointed out to us decades ago. But theology, I think, requires a great deal more faith than history does. Both are relative in the final analysis, because in both, I suspect, there are no generally agreed upon values, at least not over time. Both are very ancient, going back at least to the Greeks, perhaps the pre-Socratics. But history has not been a very sophisticated discipline until the 19th century. Both, however, as we heard at the end of this excellent presentation, are finding less and less relevance in modern society, I think because of rising secularization. And it seems to me that a conference of this nature on theology and history that can draw about two sacrament meetings in numbers is indication of that problem in our own community. Now, there are also differences. For an historian, particularly a modern-day historian, the focus is on the immanent, not the transcendent perspective. The focus is on the rational, not religious concepts based on faith. The focus is more on evolution than on design, and on men rather than providence, which is to say that we too have been largely secularized from a position more religious some decades ago. So, in a section in a conference such as this, what is the connection between history and theology, both for Christians and for Mormons? I would suggest that for the professional historian at least, the connection is a tenuous one, and one fraught with lots of difficulties. Now a few comments about the excellent paper itself. One of the first evidences of this difficulty is to be found on page 1, where Professor Gosstead talks about God was in Christ, reconciling the world unto himself. That, it seems to me, is a theological statement, not an historical statement. For historians have very little to say about the relationship between God and Christ if that relationship is going to be based on evidence, particularly historical, empirical evidence. So we see the problem from the very beginning. Another small point, perhaps, in the quotation from Herbert Butterfield about religious doctrines being a part of time and historical events, and then Butterfield mentions the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. Historians have enormous problems with that because we haven't had very much experience with resurrections. We haven't had very much experience with incarnations. And crucifixions are largely out of style, out of date. Those are largely religious theological problems that I would submit are essentially beyond the scope of historical inquiry. One takes them on faith, but one does not take them on the basis of historical data. As to the committed historian, the Mormon historian, the believing historian, and the advantages to that position, surely we will recognize there are many. One sees as an insider many things outsiders do not see. But we also have shortcomings. There is a tendency, I think, in Mormon history, and has been from the inception and continues to this day, for Mormon committed and believing historians to be quite uncritical of contemporary prophets. It is almost as if they were off limits for historical analysis and historical criticism, although I suspect that may be less so if one person dies and the typical usual process of selecting the next prophet occurs. Another area of difficulty has to do with things which are off limits. To those working within the church, I am informed certain subjects have been declared to them off limits. Don't talk about the blacks and the priesthood, it was said some time ago. Don't talk about polygamy, it has been said at other periods of time. Today it is said, don't talk about the temple ceremony, despite the fact that that ceremony has been published in toto in many places and at many different times. So there are problems as well as benefits, as I'm sure Professor Gosstead would admit. I particularly appreciated his comments about the egocentricity that we find in our culture and in our faith, where we are saving our group. Those who try to rescue salvation out of all history to save it for their own group is a much-needed suggestion and corrective. And I think those outside the fold are precisely the ones to say salvation and exaltation is not just for Mormons alone. The universality, which is coming, is something I think that all of us can welcome. I'll skip over, because of time, to one or two other short points and then a concluding remark. Professor Gostad says that history is taken seriously within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, all branches of it, and I think that is true, but that is true only to a point. There is, as I have said before, whole areas that have been deliberately avoided by those who work for the organization. There is now areas considered too sacred for discussion that an empirically minded, rationally minded, non-theistic historian feels no compunctions to getting into. We take it seriously up to the point, as the Book of Mormon says, it might undermine faith. And there we start to equivocate and start to do things that are ambivalent and sometimes unscholarly. Another minor point suggesting that Mormons have given rise and have been helpful to remind us that the history of this hemisphere does not begin in 1492 or 1607. I doubt seriously if the Mormons have contributed much to the understanding of the New World. Certainly we haven't persuaded the anthropologists or the historians to take the Book of Mormon seriously, and we failed to find, I think, a single significant piece of evidence for the existence of that chronology in secular history as is commonly understood. Finally, let me skip over several other comments that I wanted to make to come to the final comment. That is, the history should be lengthened in time and broadened in scope. I can simply say I enjoyed that part of the paper the most. I think those positive suggestions are very well taken and are beginning to be internalized. And then the last point about the reflection on whether history should be seen in the church and among theologians as an ally or as an enemy. We have, I think, quite a number of people, particularly in high places, who see history as an enemy to faith, despite the fact that many historians here have said that history has built their faith and just the contrary is the result of their study of history. Nevertheless, in a speech in September of 1976, Elder Benson said the following to institute teachers and seminary teachers in this area. He said, "Sometimes gospel principles are written with such erudition and the gospel is hardly recognizable in them." He said, "Some of our teachers have said, 'I can see how the counsel to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ is applicable to gospel subjects, but what about subjects that deal with facts, such as church history?'" Going on, Brother Benson says, "I would answer this by saying that facts should not only be taught as facts, they should be taught to increase one's faith in the gospel, to build testimony." It's at that point that the professional historian parts company. We do not see, those of us who are professional historians, facts as backstopping or as data to be used to manipulate commitment to contemporary doctrines, policies, or procedures. Hopefully, we would empathetically and with broad understanding let those facts, at least to a degree, speak for themselves. It is precisely in this hostility toward history, this fear that if you let the facts speak negatively as well as affirmatively and faithfully, that you will undermine faith. It is the belief that faith is superior to history. Hopefully, I would think the truth is superior to both faith and history. So that there are some, perhaps not enemies, perhaps not foes, but who yet need to be converted to the value of historical truth. Thank you.